Hello, this is episode number 16 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, June 7th, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Thier of the Progress and Freedom Foundation, and we have several interesting issues up for discussion this week. First, Professor Tim Wu explains his wireless net neutrality proposal. Second, the United States signs a trade agreement with South Korea that includes commercial copyright protection. And finally, the Federal Communications Commission loses an appeal in an important broadcast decency case in the Second Circuit. Joining me to discuss these topics today are Technology Liberation Front contributor Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Adam.
And two very special guests are joining us as well today. Professor Tim Wu is a professor of law at Columbia University. Hi, Professor Wu.
Hi there.
And Gwen Hines is the International Affairs Director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Gwen, hello.
Hi, Adam.
Well, Professor Tim Wu, let's start with you. A few months ago, you produced a provocative report about applying net neutrality principles or Carter phone-like principles to the wireless market. It's a proposal that attracted a lot of attention, including a lot of attention from our blog, the Technology Liberation Front, and we were very critical of your proposal, but we were happy to hear from you today about what your proposal is about and why you think it's important. So tell us a little bit about it.
Well, sure. It's taken me about a month to recover from reading your blog, and here I am now. One thing I think, the whole idea is to spend some time looking at the conditions of innovation and competition in the wireless mobile market. In general, this market's gotten kind of a free pass because it is an infant industry, it's new. The government has wanted people just to have these devices. They've been focused on trying to get prices down and, you know, classical sort of telecommunications goals of getting the devices out there and trying to muster some sort of horizontal competition to keep the prices down. I think that's, generally speaking, been fairly successful. The question that I think now that becomes a more mature industry, people are starting to ask about the conditions of competition and innovation in the industry. And I guess the point of the report is trying to shed some light on those conditions and ask whether or not there are some things going on, whether, you know, a different question being whether government is appropriate to deal with them, but, you know, whether things are as good as they could be in that industry.
I see. Now, you've gotten some support from various players out there. I know Skype Corporation is one, someone who's very interested in this proposal. They have filed something for FCC proposing to apply some of these principles through a regulatory proceeding. Could you explain a little bit about what's happening there?
Yeah, well, that's right. So one of the things that I think people are concerned about is that, you know, we have a heavily vertically integrated industry. That means that, you know, the same entities, there's basically four main carriers who have an enormous amount of spectrum, a government spectrum, and they use control of that to control a lot of what happens on the airwaves, the public airwaves. And so a company like Skype obviously has some interest in trying to become a company that's able to be used over wireless devices, but they fear that in the current state of affairs, that's very unlikely or almost impossible to happen. And so they filed a petition. I don't want to get into the legal specifics, but some of the laws suggest that, in fact, the wireless industry was always supposed to be open to device attachments and third-party applications. It just hasn't been particularly well enforced. That is, Carter Phone may already be binding on the wireless industry. So that's their claim. Without getting into the law of it, I think we can see that you know, there's an obvious interest on the part of the mobile carriers in not letting Skype really be in the mobile world, at least on spectrum that they control, and so that's the conflict.
So you've also written, more recently you had an article in Forbes, I believe, about the upcoming wireless spectrum auction, and I believe the specifics here are sort of a separate issue, which is whether the FCC
right.
would impose these requirements on the winners of the spectrum auction. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, so, you know, I think the general picture, as I said, is to try and shake up competition and innovation in the wireless industry. More than one route of doing so. One is Skype's petition. Another is there is this giant auction coming up that everyone who's a telecom geek is spending their time thinking about, the very valuable 700 megahertz spectrum. And one of the ideas out there, Frontline has this idea to some extent, if you're following this, is just to condition the auction on the rule that anyone who wins this spectrum would have to make the spectrum available to any mobile device that agrees to pay for it. In other words, to create something like the Carter phone rule for that part of the spectrum. Now, you know, before you jump in and say, well, isn't this a government regulation? I mean, it is. I guess that's one answer. But the other answer is to say that this is not all of spectrum. This is suggesting that we experiment with open device entry in one part of the spectrum, namely the 700 megahertz, and see whether that creates some kind of interesting innovation. Just like, for example, you know, opening up 2.4 gigahertz, the well-known Wi-Fi band, results in sorts of innovation that people didn't expect.
So I would be interested, could you go into a little bit more detail about what the rule would look like in terms of, would it be simply a matter of it would be wholesale per bit or per second data channel that would be set, and would the prices on it be set by the FCC, or what would that process look like for coming up with the rules and enforcing the rules of the open access regime?
Yeah, Tim, I think that's a good question. I think that's the challenge of, can you create something, and you know, in your comments on this, you've pointed this out. I suppose the easiest answer to that question, one thing I want to say is I'm not done thinking about it. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I've thought through this, and I want to sort of figure out, and I've been talking with technical people about what the best way to handle this is. But basically, I think that the idea would be that you could that they would be in a position of selling bandwidth and not. It would be in a position whereby anyone who wanted to use bandwidth on that in those bands would pay whatever rate they choose. In other words, they're simply a supplier with. And if the prices did get out of control, the FCC or other entities could step into it. But I don't anticipate it being an FCC rule, but rather a privately set rule with the condition that it be open and available to anyone, and with prices set at that depending on how much is demanded.
Well, Professor, I'd like to ask you a question about your underlying assumption in your report seems to be that this market lacks the sufficient level of competition to sort of self-police itself. You've called it an oligopoly, and that four firms or whatever it is per market is not enough. I guess my first question is, how many competitors do you think would be enough per market? And frankly, four competitors in a market in a communications, a heavy sunk fixed cost market like communications, that sounds pretty good to me. I think we're lucky to actually have four, and in some cases, in some markets, major metropolitan markets, more than that. And then secondly, you know, if you think that four is not, you know, that we're talking about regulating essentially the entire U.S. cellular market, because most markets don't have a lot more than that. So how do you respond to that?
No, I'm not focused on the number of competitors. I mean, I think that I do agree that, you know, in this, telecom markets are more market failure than they are market, to be blunt. And I do think that there are a decent number of competitors, and better than you might have, in fact, had expected. It is an unusual market. You have to pay billions of dollars to get into it. It's not, you know, like starting a 7-Eleven or something, or you know, you have to. You need spectrum, and if you don't have any spectrum, you basically aren't in that market at all. So I don't want, you know, get into this game of numbers. I think that the problem is that you have parallel practices, at least right now, fairly parallel practices with respect to how open the markets are to outside on the application and the device side. And so my concern is, you know, not the numbers, but do we have a limited number of companies who are basically pursuing parallel policies and therefore blocking innovation at device and application layers. That's what I'm really concerned about. I'm not, my views on antitrust is I'm not a person who's obsessed with trying to break competitors into tiny little pieces. I'm interested in company behavior. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you had one or two companies that were behaving well and were, behaving properly, I'm the kind of person who doesn't have a problem with that. It's the blocking innovation at different markets that bothers me, or related vertical
okay,
markets
well,
that bothers
let's,
me.
Let's talk about that innovation question and that blocking question a bit more. And
sure.
Tim Lee, I know you just wrote a piece this week for Cato talking a bit about this, responding to Professor Wu's concerns, so I'm going to ask you to follow up. But I just wanted to ask this question about, you know, is there a lot of or a lack of openness in this market? I mean, isn't it, first of all, as a threshold matter, the case that it's almost impossible for a cellular phone to be perfectly unlocked or perfectly open in the sense that there have to be some types of standards about how a phone is used technically with a network. And there are going to be certain restrictions on device attachments, but so long as we have some other alternatives, what's the problem? I mean, for example, we know Verizon has somewhat slightly more restrictive practices than, say, Singular on certain things, or when it comes to, say, unlocking a GSM phone or something. But you can find an alternative in this marketplace. And so I'm not quite sure there's the technical concern or problem there that you're saying there is, and it certainly doesn't seem to be a consumer outcry about that being a problem. But Tim Lee, let me let you pick up on this before I let Professor Wu answer us, because I know you have similar questions in your piece.
Sure. Well, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, Adam. I'm not sure that it's true that it would not be possible in theory to have a completely open broadband network. I mean, obviously, you would need to have some rules, some standards, but I think that it would be perfectly feasible and probably desirable to have a network where basically the only job the network does is to send bits from point A to point B. The question I see is that the mechanics of making that happen in the teeth of fierce opposition from entrenched incumbents, my reading of history is that that's it doesn't always fail, but it often fails, and even when it succeeds, it's a very expensive and messy procedure. So I just think we should be very, very hesitant to get into that unless we've exhausted other possibilities.
Right. And my answer to Tim, Adam, I'm running away from your question, but I'll get back to it, is that I consider that to be surrender. The idea that once you say that we can't do something because the lobbying opposition to it would be so strong, that's essentially giving up on the form of government that we're supposed to have here, which is that the people decide what to do, and if companies don't like it, that's too bad. I agree the wireless industry likes things the way they are. They like controlling all the revenue and trying to sop it all up and they have plans. You know, sometimes I think are actually counter to their own interests, but, they're obviously not listening to me. But let me get back to Adam's question. Is there always an alternative? I think when you have, first of all, when you do, and I guess I'm getting slightly back to numbers, when you have a limited number of competitors who pursue parallel practices, that's not always a viable option, particularly when they are, sort of culturally all from this, the Bell tradition. When the Bell tradition, these are the last descendants of the Bell system, and that tradition suggests that you control everything on the network. It is philosophically against the idea of open market entry into applications and devices. And so I think that, whether it's consumer pressure, whether it's government, whether it's something, you need to have a discussion and at last resort, a real government action to try to kind of get innovation moving in this sector. Now, I'm not saying there's no innovation. I'm just saying there's not the kind that the United States is capable of producing. I mean, America is the leading innovator in most sectors of the high-tech economy. The major exception is mobile, and I think it's because we don't really have our best, the full powers of America's innovation engines allowed to train on this problem of mobile applications. Because it's basically, what does Verizon think and what does AT&T think? And if they think that something's a good idea, we have a innovation policy which is gatekeeped right now by those particular players, and I think you see the results. If we look at all the other areas of technical innovation, they're much better performers than we are in cell phones, and I think the answer is obvious.
I have a hard time believing that the marketplace, you're talking about American being the most innovative culture, technology culture, except for wireless, but in the mobile sector, I'm looking at the Amazon webpage right now where I find something like 160 plus GSM phones, just GSM I'm looking at, and I look at the number of handsets I can choose from just any individual carrier, and I look at the number of applications I can receive over these things, and I wonder myself, what is the innovation exactly that you're saying we're missing or being denied because of the current state of affairs? And then secondly, I want you to answer the question, Professor, about what this does to the prices of the underlying handset or initial contract, right? Because I think you would agree that these service plans right now are heavily, the handsets are heavily subsidized, and that's why we have certain restrictions on the plans.
Those are great questions, and let me answer both of them with some relish. The first question is, on application development. This is not Tim Wu's personal opinion. This is from talking to a lot of application developers, successful application developers in this field, saying that, you know, the web world, the computer world, the software world, and mobile are completely different creatures. That the, you know, the practices they're used to are absolutely the opposite, and that they find themselves wanting to do things and having themselves stopped by the carriers. So, you know, I'm just reflecting their testimony. A lot of these people will not come forth and talk about this issue because they're afraid of retaliation. But I am reflecting what the application industry is telling me, and some of them are complaining. I mean, you just have to spend any time at a mobile conference, and all anyone does is complain about how the carriers won't let them do what they want to do. And so I think we have strong, at least, testimonial evidence that the full engines of American innovation in this sector are not operating at full capacity. The second question is, you know, won't consumers pay more? Consumers always pay. You know, the fact that you get a $10 phone doesn't mean you don't pay for the $200 phone. It means you pay for it in higher rates, right? And so there's no magic trick whereby consumers are saving money under the current system. They just have a buy-now, pay-later system where you pay, you know, you get a $200 discount on your phone and you pay it in higher rates later on. So, you know, I don't think there's any, I mean, consumers might not like bearing or they don't like, and people like buy-now, pay-later kind of programs. They make you feel like you're saving money. You're not. And in fact, if you could, you know, have a naked program, it would obviously be cheaper if they didn't build that subsidy into it that you pay over the years. And of course, your phone would cost more up front. But you know, if you're an economist, you don't really care where the costs come out, unless you just think that people psychologically want to buy stuff that's cheaper. I don't think we need. I mean, we used to be in a state where you might have wanted to absolutely try and get everyone on wireless, and that's why you want to support a program that's a $10 phone. And I think there's no problem with continuing to support that. But the idea that prices will really go up is just not true.
Let me.
So you hope.
Yeah. So Professor, let me ask a specific question that actually our colleague Jerry Brito brought up the last time we discussed this on the podcast. And that's about the iPhone, which Jerry is eagerly awaiting his own iPhone. And one of the features that the iPhone has is a video voicemail feature, where instead of having to wait for the whole list and pressing one or two on your keypad, it actually shows you a list of the specific voicemail messages, and you can access them in a random order. And this is something that is not something that you can, as I understand it, that you could implement entirely on the device side. You have to have some support on the network side for that kind of functionality. So my question is, if you did have a wireless Carter phone rule, what would it have to say about those sorts of features? Would it be strictly a data plan where AT&T wouldn't have to provide any sort of support, or would there be some sort of rule where AT&T would have to provide comparable service to any device maker or any application maker for a feature like that?
Right. It's a great question, Tim, and it's really a question that comes from, and it's a mini version of the same question in net neutrality, which is our other favorite topic. I've always had the position that there are, of course, certain advantages to offering certain types of vertically integrated services. I mean, you said voice mail, but you might as well just say voice also. You know, there's a lot of advantages to controlling the whole to knowing what's going on the phone and having complete control over the whole network to ensure a better quality voice. There's no question about that. And I think when, you know, people choose Verizon Voice over other applications, that's fine. The only problem I have, and so nothing I would suggest would ever suggest a ban on creating, good quality applications. Right now I'm talking to you on a cable voice over IP line, which again is a product of vertical integration, and I think a successful one. The only problem is when they start to block the non-vertically integrated versions or ways of competing with that product, and that's where I think the problem lies. It could be that you can do voice email without vertical integration, without cooperating all the way up. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't really know, but maybe. People have been surprised about voice over IP working without vertical integration. Skype is the example. Vonage also. You know, these things work to people's surprise. And the problem is that when the carriers have their own vertically integrated service, and when they technically assume another one can't work and therefore block it off, that's where I start to have problems. But nothing I've ever advocated would say that if you want to use your facilities and try and deliver great service, whether that's, you know, television delivered by TV stations or cablecom, voice delivered by anyone else or anything else, you might as well go for it. And that's the balance I'm trying to strike.
Mm-hmm. But isn't there also a price issue here? I mean, one of the problems is, let's say that we get a wireless Carter phone rule that says that carriers have to allow Skype over their phones. Can't the phone company just price, basically say you have to buy the the Verizon voice service, which costs $40 a month, and then you can also pay for bandwidth on top of that. But if you're already getting the voice with the basic plan, isn't the FCC going to have to get into the issue of what bundles of service phone companies have to offer and what things can or can't be in the basic bundle?
You know, I hope not, and I would think that the answer, it depends on what exactly we're talking about, and I can see your concern, but I would suggest that, you know, when we will end up somewhere where we are actually with net neutrality, which is to say that, you know, people are selling when people are selling a data service, you know, they're selling it as a data service and selling it in a neutral and open way. And, you know, maybe they'll try and price it, but then if they do price it out of control, then no one will buy it, and so they'll lose some of the advantages of offering the service in the first place. I mean, that's how I see this kind of thing working out. I'm a little bit allergic or hesitant to advocate price-fixing types of measures. I think you do need to have some kind of final control and, you know, the possibility of some kind of price controls if something goes out of control, but I hesitate strongly to recommend them. But it is a good question whether, you know, misbehavior and you know, Tim, you're a cynic and you think the incumbents will always try and do something to make the price completely unattractive, and there's a possibility.
So you think that once you sort of force the phone companies to offer this service, they'll sort of figure out that it's actually a profitable opportunity and price it reasonably rather than continuing to resist by overcharging for it and effectively killing it in the cradle?
That's what I think. Yes, I think that, you know, if they, I know there's also internal battles inside of these companies. There's people inside these companies who think they'll make more money on an open system, mm-hmm. and you know, I think that once sort of led that way or coerced that way, if a couple carriers start to make money off of it, as they are, I mean, they're making a ton of money in regular neutral broadband as well. Mm-hmm. That those kind of services will end up being attractive, and you know, then and so I think there's conflict inside the carriers, which I'm trying to put a thumb on the scale. How's that?
Right. Well, let me just say that I do think that one of the valuable things about your report was that it did a great job of highlighting some of these issues. And my hope actually is that before we get to the point of enacting regulations, that some of those points might make their way into the carriers, and some of them might start either to preempt regulation or just because, you know, the arguments make sense, some of them might start opening their networks without having to get into a messy regulatory battle over it.
Right. Okay, I have no attachment to any means. I'm sorry, but it's only ends. Mm-hmm. I think that this mobile environment has some very good features, but it could become a real engine of U.S. innovation, and I think that change, I don't care how it comes, but that's the direction I want to push things.
Okay, we're going to move on to our next issue then of the recent U.S. trade agreement with South Korea that includes some controversial copyright provisions. Gwen Hintz of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, you've been monitoring these developments. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what's going on and what concerns you about this trade agreement?
Sure, thanks very much for the invitation to come on the podcast today. So South Korea has just signed a free trade agreement with the United States that, at least in EFF's view, will put severe restrictions on its ability to innovate. So the South Korean free trade agreement is one part of a larger picture. For those people who haven't been following this, since 2002, the last 9 free trade agreements that the United States has entered into with its trading partners have included a range of fairly specific intellectual property obligations, and those have generally required a higher level of protection of various types of intellectual property above the international standards that we see in multilateral treaties. So the South Korean Free Trade Agreement is similar in many respects to the previous free trade agreements, but also has a couple of features that make it interesting and distinctive. So just to give the features that are, I guess, common to the previous free trade agreements, as I said, the last 9 and now 10, including Korea, South Korea, have included these features, for instance. So we've seen in the copyright sphere, free trade agreements have required America's trading partners to create anti-circumvention laws that mirror very precisely the U.S. approach in the more controversial Digital Millennium Copyright Act from 1998.
Just to jump in there, my understanding is that it's a little bit more in some cases, those provisions are a little bit more restrictive than the DMCA. Is that true?
You have to look at them one by one. There are some differences between the free trade agreements on this. They have all had in common the requirement that America's trading partners adopt a framework that mirrors the U.S. approach, in that it is a very precise way of implementing the international obligation that exists under the WIPO Copyright Treaty and the Performances and Phonograms Treaty from 1996. And they're precise in the sense that they require both a ban on the act of circumvention and also a ban on circumvention tools, to put it in sort of broad terms. And they all also require countries to adopt the same seven exceptions and limitations that are in the US DMCA approach. And in some cases, so for instance, in the case of the Australian Free Trade Agreement, that required Australia to rewrite its pre-existing 2000 law that had already implemented those obligations in a way that the US copyright industry described in the Industry Functional Advisory Committee report on that free trade agreement. They described the Australian laws as a dangerous loophole. So there is some variation between the free trade agreements on things such as the level of knowledge. Some of the free trade agreements have not even required that there be knowing circumvention. The South Korean free trade agreement is better in some respects than some of the earlier ones in that it has a requirement for a knowing circumvention, but also requires injunctive relief where there's that infringement or that circumvention leads to copyright infringement.
Gwen, can I ask you a question, which is, generally speaking, at a very broad level, what is EFF's position with regards to attaching IP-related conditions to trade deals? This has been something that's been controversial in libertarian-type circles for a long time. I know I used to debate with friends of mine when I worked at Cato about should IP and copyright be part of free trade agreements. I think Tim Lee raised this point in a blog this week. I think it was you, Tim.
Yep.
What does EFF say about that?
Well, as an organization, EFF doesn't take a position on whether free trade agreements are good or bad per se. But on the question of whether they're a good vehicle for creating international copyright norms, we think they're not a good vehicle, and we think that part of the reason they're not a good vehicle is because what's happened in recent years, I've given you one example of things that have been in the last 9 free trade agreements, but there are a number of features, just to really quickly give you sort of the full flavour of this. The free trade agreement have also required American trading partners to adopt the US copyright term of life plus 70 years, and also required American trading partners to treat temporary reproductions of copyrighted works, such as those in computer RAM, as copyright infringement. That's a really big issue for internet communication. Unfortunately, while the free trade agreements have been very efficient at harmonizing the normative parts of US copyright law, what they haven't done, and I guess the reason for our concern about using free trade agreements to do part of this job, is they haven't harmonized or exported the accompanying exceptions and limitations that exist in US law that provide balance between private and public interests and also provide room for the American tech industries to innovate. We see none of those features in the free trade agreements. So the free trade agreements have been controversial, I think, for many people in across the political spectrum because they have exported these standards.
So Gwen, I certainly agree with you that some of these specific provisions are not a good idea in their merit and don't belong in trade agreements. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what sort of procedural changes you would like to see in the process through which we negotiate free trade agreements with other countries. If we are going to do this, what can we do to make sure that these sort of non-trade related provisions don't end up sneaking into these agreements, or at least that they're, for example, is this an argument against having fast-track authority so Congress can examine these more, or does there need to be some change in the negotiation process, or what would you say needs to be changed in that respect?
Well, that's a really complex but a very worthwhile question. EFF is not primarily a lobbying agency, so we don't have a particular political agenda here. We're not based in D.C. We're obviously, one of the points you raise is a really good one. One of the reasons why free trade agreements have been so effective at harmonizing the norms is because they require trading partners to trade off various things that are not related. So intellectual property is one of nine chapters of different sectors and different forms, different parts of agreement that are part of any one free trade agreement. So in effect, what we're asking our trading partners, the negotiators on the other side of this bargaining table to agree to, is a trade-off between things like access to the U.S. agricultural or textile market and trading off particular provisions, putting particular provisions in their information policy that may not serve the best needs of their citizens or of their domestic technology sector.
Are there upcoming agreements that we should be concerned about on this front?
One of the features of the free trade agreements is that the terms that are being negotiated are not made public until after they've been agreed between the two countries. So, in effect, it's not possible to know what's in any upcoming free trade agreement. This obviously is a matter of some concern for both U.S. domestic constituencies who have concerns such as the tech sector and consumer movements, but also obviously for foreign countries as well. You can't actually see the text until it's agreed, and then at least in the United States framework, it's usually too late at that point to have any changes made to the free trade agreement. One thing that you mentioned previously, Tim, was that the fast track authority, and one of the features of that process of having an expedited regime that allows fast track allows these free trade agreements to be fast-tracked through Congress is that it only requires or only allows an up or down vote. So unfortunately, what congressional representatives are asked to do is vote on the free trade agreement as a whole, and that actually reduces the ability for congressional representatives to have a solid policy debate about one particular part of the free trade agreement, whether it's the Digital Money and Copyright Act type provisions, temporary reproduction, any aspect of the patent provisions or protection for exclusive test data that relate to the ability of other countries to register generic medicines. All of those very specific aspects of one of the nine chapters of a free trade agreement don't get to have consideration in and of their own right because of the way that the system is set up at the moment in the United States. And to answer your previous question, there's another free trade agreement pending with Panama that we haven't seen the terms of yet. The South Korean free trade agreement, as I said, has features in common with the last nine free trade agreements. But the two things that I think are worth drawing to your listeners' attention are a good and a bad point. One of the things that has been a problem in the previous free trade agreements, at least from the point of view of internet innovation, has been this fact that the free trade agreements have required trading partners to treat all temporary reproductions, including in computer RAM, as actionable copyright infringement. But at the same time, the free trade agreements have not, for instance, exported fair use limitation, which exists in US law and which gives a lot of room for innovation and makes possible things such as search engines. And it's worth noting that in the United States, for instance, the Ninth Circuit recently affirmed in Perfect Ten versus Google that under U.S. law, temporary copies are necessary to enable end use of internet technologies such as search engines, and are therefore fair use and not copyright infringement. One good feature of the South Korean Free Trade Agreement is that, curiously enough, there seems to be a footnote there that might permit South Korea and the United States, obviously, to create fair use exceptions for temporary reproductions. So that's the good news that I want to flag. The bad news that I want to flag is a very specific set of obligations that are included in a side letter to the Free Trade Agreement that require the parties to agree on the objective of shutting down internet sites that permit the unauthorized reproduction, distribution, and transmission of copyrighted works. We have in the United States taken a sound policy decision to have special rules for ISPs that allow them to conduct their business without fear of crippling lawsuits. Those safe harbors in U.S. copyright law have made it into all the last nine free trade agreements and into the South Korean free trade agreement. But there is damaging or disturbing language in the third side letter that raises questions about whether there might be extrajudicial relief possible for concerned U.S. rights holders to seek to have various parts of the internet shut down on the potential request for a mere allegation of copyright infringement.
Finally, in this week's podcast, I want to turn to an issue that I've been writing about on the blog for quite a bit over the last few months and just give a quick brief update on what's been happening in the courts in the case of Fox television stations versus FCC. This is the case where the networks, Fox and CBS in particular, have sued the Federal Communications Commission for their policy about indecency content regulation. And this is not the Janet Jackson case, which is being heard later this year in the Third Circuit. This is a different case that was being heard in the Second Circuit. I'm pleased to report that just a few days ago, the decision came down in the Second Circuit and that Fox won that case, and that part of the decision in the case by the Second Circuit borrowed heavily from a joint amicus brief that the Center for Democracy and Technology and I filed, in which we made the argument that internet law and video game law had a bearing on this case, and the court listened to us. What they said is that they were overturning the FCC's actions, not on First Amendment grounds so much, but on procedural grounds, but in some so-called dicta in the case, some of the extra thoughts that they put in there. They quoted, or they borrowed directly from some of the stuff that CDT and PFF had filed, and specifically said that it is, quote, increasingly difficult to describe the broadcast media as uniquely pervasive and uniquely accessible to children, and at some point in the future, strict scrutiny may properly apply in the context of regulating broadcast television, end quote.
Wow.
It's a very big deal, because that that would undo, if it became the law of the land, a lot of the last 30 or 40 years' worth of FCC rulemaking and regulation under the Red Lion doctrine and Pacifica. And then secondly, the court went on to say, and this is really what CDT and PFF had focused on in our brief, the court said, quote, the proliferation of satellite and cable television channels, not to mention internet-based video outlets, has begun to erode the uniqueness of broadcast media, while at the same time, blocking technologies have empowered viewers to make their own choices about what they do and do not want to see on television. And they went on to conclude, technological advances may obviate the constitutional legitimacy of the FCC's robust oversight, end quote. So that's pretty strong stuff coming from any court, but when it comes from a major U.S. Circuit court, it's a very big deal, because the next step up the food chain would be the Supreme Court if the FCC appealed.
Wow, that's fantastic. Is that do you get the sense that is the Second Circuit a liberal or conservative circuit, and do you get any sense if other circuits are willing to follow their lead?
Well, there were only three judges involved in this particular ruling. It was a 2-1 decision, but the two in favor of Fox in this case, in the majority, one was a Democrat appointed by Clinton, one was a Republican appointed by Bush. So it's one of these things where I don't see a clear ideological split on the courts. And frankly, all of this good case law that's been coming out of the Supreme Court over the last 10 years has had a mixed majority every time, and in some cases a full majority that included both Democrat and Republican appointees. So free speech has always been a funny issue, especially at the court level. And I get the sense that if this is appealed to the Supreme Court, there's a good chance that it would side with the Second Circuit on this. But the FCC is currently weighing its options. We're not sure where it goes next, but I think it plays into the hand of those who want to advance a legislative agenda to regulate not just indecency, but also televised violence, which is something we've also been talking about. So it remains to be seen, but the important point about this case that I thought our listeners would be interested in is that what we've been saying in our work at PFF and also CDT has, is that internet law and video game law and new media law was long going to be on a collision course with the old media world, and now it's happening in the courts. And this is really, I think, the first of many legal skirmishes where we'll see internet law make a difference for old media.
Do you think that the time is ripe yet for a frontal assault on the Red Lion line? I mean, do you think that if we found a case where we just made the argument that indecency restrictions are an infringement on free speech, that you'd be able to get a court to buy that, or is that still a few years down the road?
Well, we'll have to wait and see what happens in the Third Circuit later this year with the Janet Jackson case, which is a little bit touchier of a case, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And if the court sides with the networks on that and again cites this kind of language, because we filed an amicus brief in that case as well, if they again cite the sort of language that the Second Circuit did that we pushed upon them, I think there's a very good chance that if this goes to the Supreme Court, you will have a historic First Amendment decision potentially overturning at least the Pacifica decision, if not going back all the way to Red Lion. and touching that as well. So big things could be happening at the courts, and we really have to thank for this all that great internet jurisprudence that's been handed down over the last 10 years, which has been rock-solid First Amendment-oriented jurisprudence. That's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Professor Tim Wu, Gwen Hinz, and Tim Lee for joining us. And to read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to comment about something you heard here today, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this particular show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thayer. See you.